Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi there, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Before we get started today, I'd just like to let you know about Streetwise Hebrew for the TOI community. Those are bite-sized audio Hebrew classes. More about that at the end of today's podcast. Today is Sunday, October 10th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. Joining me today are Times of Israel founding editor David Horovitz and diplomatic correspondent Lazer Berman. Shavua Tov and hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Good morning, Shavua Tov.
Lazer, let's get started with you. You have a really wonderful piece at the top of the page right now about an official Bahraini visit to Israel, to Jerusalem, to sites all over the country. And they're having a very interesting experience, I think. It's a pretty long visit, right? 12 days?
It is. And this was a fun story to do. And it's something that's gotten a lot of interest across Israel, across the world. Even my nephew's Levi and Meir in America. And people just around here are really connected to seeing some of the real fruits of the Abraham Accord. So this is the first visit by a delegation since the embassy was opened. I was there about 10 days ago in Manama to open the embassy, or to see Foreign Minister Yair Lapid open the embassy. And that trip was particularly warm. And I think we can see some of this real intention by the Bahraini government and some of civil society to really invest in this relationship, maybe even more than some of the other Abraham Accord countries are. So this group was brought to Israel by an NGO called Sharaka, which came about in the wake of the Abraham Accords and is trying to connect civil society in the Abraham Accords countries. And these individuals are in the education ministry. Some are business people. Some are activists, very, very interesting group. And they have been going around to Israel. Some is meeting with other young Israeli tech types, some meeting, we're at the foreign ministry. But the most interesting part for me was walking through Jerusalem, through the old city, and especially down to the Kotel. Now, when they went down to the Kotel, the Western Wall, it was filled with mostly ultra-Orthodox prayer goers, the middle of the day. There was a lot of bar mitzvahs going on because it was Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the Jewish month. And I'll be honest, I didn't know how they would be received. Anyone is allowed to go down to the Western Wall, but they were dressed in really that Gulf robe and the headdress, the keffiyeh, and they started praying at the wall out of a sign of respect. They're at a Jewish holy site, and what they wanted to do was to offer a prayer there in a very open and ecumenical way. And you never know what everyone's going to do. Some of the people at the wall aren't necessarily that cosmopolitan, don't know anything about politics, and they see who is this Muslim Arab praying at our site. Is this political? I was very pleased to see that there was no negative anything. At worst, there were some curious sights. You know, this is not something we always see. But then people started pulling out phones. Some of the bar mitzvah families invited them over, gave them candy to throw at the bar mitzvah boy. And there's pictures after pictures, handshakes, welcome, we love you. People tried out their Arabic. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But even ultra-Orthodox schoolgirls all dressed in the same type of uniform, kind of shyly coming over. But, you know, we have a picture up of them standing around a young man dressed in that Gulf Arab garb and having a conversation. So I think it was eye-opening for the Bahrainis, and I think even more so for the Israelis, and hopefully it's a sign of things to come. It's important to note, however, that consistently, no matter where we were, whether we were out on the Armon HaNatziv Tayelet, Old City, even in Tel Aviv, Israeli Arabs and Palestinians are incredibly hostile to this visit. They're taking pictures from the side, cursing them out, playing loud nationalistic music. The Bahrainis took it in stride. They said, you know, we get worse from Palestinians in Bahrain and on social media. But it was striking to see the contrast between the reaction and the excitement from Jewish Israelis and the hostility and opposition from Arab Israelis and East Jerusalem Palestinians.
Lazer, any women in the Bahraini delegation?
Absolutely. It's mostly women. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by the fact that many of the women are athletes. So there's one who's a boxer and another one who's on the board of weightlifting in Bahrain. So these are interesting and active people. One of the women, her name is Asma, she speaks Hebrew. She studied Hebrew in Cairo and she founded the Shemot Institute, which teaches Hebrew in Bahrain. So she was here. She speaks biblical Hebrew, modern Hebrew. And that is obviously something that is a nice surprise and a very interesting part of this delegation.
Wow, that is completely wild. David, going over to you now, I wanted you to comment on several situations that are unfolding. Let's start with the Lebanon power cuts. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just to pick up on Laser's thing, you know, and I mean, there's a connection to Lebanon, which I'll come to in a second. But it is incredible. It's incredible scenes that he describes. And I'm not surprised that Laser was intrigued to see how this visit would go down at the Western Wall. You know, the incredible tolerance and curiosity, and it contrasts with, you know, the routine confrontations when non-Orthodox women, when the women of the wall try to pray at the Kotel. And, you know, there's stuff just in the last few days. There was a protest in the Knesset, you know, in the relevant committee meeting, and an ultra-Orthodox Knesset member disturbed the meeting by loudly reading Psalms. And their committee head, who's a Reform rabbi, had delivered a Sefer Torah to the women. You know, we've talked about this all the time, but what a contrast with some very respectful Muslims looking very clearly like they were Muslims, being welcomed and embraced so warmly. You know, it's really great, and one wishes that the tolerance was you know, more universal. And then, you know, we're jumping wildly here, but there is a connection. You know, we're reporting Lebanon's having. Basically, Lebanon's gone dark for anyone who's on the national grid, which is they're out of power in Lebanon. They're out of power in Lebanon because the country's dysfunctional economically, and it's not the sole reason. But the fact is that Lebanon is dominated by a terrorist organization. It's an army, Hezbollah. It's an Iranian funded, armed, inspired army. The popular figure that's often cited is that there's 150,000 rockets and missiles of Hezbollah, all pointed at Israel. I'm reliably assured that the figure is wrong. It's only, quote-unquote, 70,000, and I have that on very high authority. But, you know, if all your resources are being poured, or much of your national resources is being poured into attempting to maintain a pose of confrontation against the country next door, if you're spending all your money on that, or loads and loads of money on that, and if people from abroad who assert that they have your country's best interests at heart are ensuring that that's where the money goes, there's going to be less money for things like, you know, electricity. And it's the other side of the story that Laser reported. Here are people coming from a distant country. Some of the things they say are so remarkable about how they were educated and what they didn't know about Jews and Israel, and opening their eyes and wanting to learn more. And, you know, for sure this is a honeymoon period, but they're trying to make sure that this honeymoon lasts. And that everybody benefits from it. And there, you know, 3-4 hours to the north across the border is a country that's being plunged ever further backwards, in part because so much of their resources are dedicated to harming us.
Laser, were these topics that came up in conversation in the visit?
We didn't get too deep into the hardcore security side of things. But as David was referencing, we did talk about education and what the vision is for the future. And one young woman said to me very clearly, if we hold on to the grudges of our ancestors, it's going to destroy us. And this is exactly what we see in Lebanon. And it's becoming very stark that there are two camps in the Middle East. And it's not necessarily religious, but it's whether you want to hold on to this idea of resistance and destroying Israel in opposition to the West, or whether you say there's an opportunity to do things together here to build a better future for our children, and to really have a positive son relationship with Israel, with the West, and with each other. And we can do away with all this hostility, war, and these grudges about the past. And I think it's very stark and it's very clear.
This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sacks, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's KORENPUB.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
Another related topic about Ron Arad, the Israeli airman, who there has been some new alleged details published in an Arabic language newspaper about Israel's supposed kidnapping of an Iranian general as part of efforts to find new information.
Yeah, we've reported this. There's been lots of twists and turns in this story about an operation that was actually initially revealed early last week by Prime Minister Bennett, that Israel had been, the Mossad had been doing stuff beyond Israel's borders to try and determine the fate of this this Israeli airman, who is presumed dead, but the full story is not known. I'm very struck that there was that story which has been playing out in the last few days, and there's also been a story about an alleged Iranian-inspired effort to kill Israeli business people or to target Israelis in Cyprus. And what struck me in both of these stories, you know, looking at what we do, is the difficulty at getting to the truth and the clear indications that official Israeli sources of information are not always, I mean, you understand when people can't tell you the full story, but it's increasingly dismaying when people who you need to rely on appear to be disseminating misinformation. So in the case of Ron Arad, I don't know what the truth is. The Prime Minister, when he when he unveiled the fact that the Mossad had been working to try and find out again what became of Ron Arad, said the operation to find information was a success. Then there were background briefings asserting that absolutely this was not a success. It was a courageous. We were told that the head of the Mossad in private meetings has said this was a daring and courageous and complex operation, but it was a failure. Then we were told again by credible people who did not want to be quoted, no, actually it was a success. It's very hard to get to the truth of that. The Cyprus one, you know, very different, but lots of a certain amount of connections and similarities, certainly in the way that we're trying to find out what happened. The original story was that a particular Israeli business person had been targeted in Cyprus, and official sources, I think in the Prime Minister's office, were letting it be known that this was not terrorism. This was not a case of terrorism, the implication being that the businessman in question was being targeted in some criminal attempt. And then we were told, no, actually, this was terrorism. I'm not sure unprecedented, but considerable amounts of misinformation being deliberately disseminated. It makes our job very difficult in trying to have people understand what's going on. And like I say, for me, among the more dismaying aspects of in both of these cases and others recently is that when people who you need to rely on and who you would expect, sorry, we can't tell you the full story at the moment, when some of those people are actually telling you things that, as far as I can tell, they would know are not entirely true. You know, that's just incredibly problematic. And I think it's a trend. That's the way things seem to be going. That's the direction things seem to be going. And it's very problematic.
Let me just clarify that. That's the way things seem to be going in terms of disseminating the news that we then have to report.
Yeah. I mean, I look, journalism has always been facing the challenge of needing to be fairly rapid and fairly accurate. I mean, you'd like to be as fast as possible and as accurate as possible. And those two imperatives are contradictory. I think as the years have passed, and I'm, you know, sounding old here, but I've been doing this for a long time, that challenge is getting harder and harder. And what's exacerbating that challenge increasingly, I think, is people who are deliberately misinforming. I'm sure all of this has happened throughout history. The particular way that we convey information, the tools that we have to do so quickly, the potential to mislead and manipulate, you know, are particularly great at the moment. And therefore, I think the challenge is, you know, it's getting harder. And I would just hope that people, you know, who are in positions of authority, you know, they owe it to the publics that they serve. To try not to mislead the people who are trying to inform those publics.
Laser, on the topic of confusing stories, you wrote pretty extensively about the Sugihara saga, the son of the Japanese envoy who saved thousands of Jews from the Nazis, and now his son wanted to come to Israel for an official ceremony, but had his entry visa denied. Unpack this for us. Tell us what happened. Explain it, please.
So this was almost too starkly ironic to be nonfiction, but this is a situation we found ourselves in on Thursday, last Thursday. So on tomorrow, there's going to be a Jerusalem municipality ceremony naming a square in the Kiryat Yovel neighborhood after Chune Sugihara, who was a vice consul of the Japanese Empire in Kovno, Lithuania, as Jews call it, Kaunas, as Lithuanians call it. And he saved thousands of Jews by issuing visas against regulation so that they could take the Trans-Siberian Highway off east, either to Japan or to Shanghai, which was occupied by the Japanese at the time. There's an estimated 100,000 descendants of the Jews that he saved alive today. So there's a lot of people that that have him to thank. One of the descendants got in touch with us and alerted us that his son, Nobuki Sugihara, was not being allowed to come into Israel to be at the ceremony because he was missing some documents to get the official visa. And again, this is someone who let Jews in, even though they didn't have, you know, any of the official documents that they needed. And his son is getting stuck on bureaucratic holdups about documents. Now, I spoke to someone who was involved in planning the municipality ceremony. He says he's told the son what he needs to submit to get in. And the son says some of these things, like where he'll quarantine if he is found positive with COVID, are the responsibility of the host. But in short, yeah, it was a couple of specific documents, and Israeli bureaucracy was not letting the son of this hero in. We wrote the article. It caused quite a stir. Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked read it. She gave orders to do everything to get them in. Other individuals, including the foreign ministry, read it, were embarrassed, saw how, you know, how this looks and the moral problem with not letting the son in. And by Friday, the issue was sorted out. And him, some other family members and some friends will be there tomorrow for the ceremony. There's also supposed to be a JNF ceremony, but that was postponed when he couldn't get in. So that might happen as well. But the big ceremony is tomorrow in Jerusalem. So
less again, than 24 hours from the time that you wrote the article?
That he was allowed in?
Yeah.
It was less than that. We published it on Thursday, and by Friday morning, I woke up to messages that had all been sorted out. It was very clear that this really touched some nerves across government ministries and some frustration that Israeli bureaucracy is holding things up like this. And, you know, especially with COVID, when there's changing rules and changing,
right,
authorities, and it's not clear who's responsible for what. But in this case, senior officials were able to cut through the red tape. I wouldn't be so optimistic for people who are less notable and who are less newsworthy than the son of Chune Sugihara.
Yes, we'll never assume that for sure. Okay, let's end on a positive note. David, one of your favorite topics, soccer.
It's not a positive note, Jessica. It's a negative note. Sorry.
I know it's negative, but it's a positive topic generally. It's negative. I'm sorry. yes, Israel's national soccer team was defeated. Okay, so that's not really very positive.
In the fourth minute of stoppage time, I have to put this in language that that American non-soccer fan. First of all, it's football, not soccer. We're just not going to go there.
The sorry. Bottom line okay. is... Okay, I'm an American...
It's okay. Israel will not be broadening its relations in Qatar on the soccer field, it would appear, next year, because there was a pretty crucial qualifying match last night where Israel was playing in Scotland, who are a very good team, and Israel started incredibly well. They scored first. They led a second time 2-1. Towards the very end of the game, it was 2-2, which would still have kept Israel's World Cup hopes alive. And then in the final minutes of stoppage time, the ball was bundled into the Israeli net, and Scotland was very happy, and Israel is very sad. That's the bottom line.
David, what is stoppage time?
it's not even called that. I just thought you might understand it if I said that. It's called injury time. It used to be called injury time. It's the minutes that they add on because things happen during the regulation 90 minutes, so they give a little bit of extra. And they tell you ahead of time. It's not some sort of sneaky ruse. It wasn't, it was nothing nefarious there. But in those final dying seconds of the game, when Israel was still hanging on there, defeat reared its head.
Well, the episode I watched of Ted Lasso was a little bit more positive last night.
Yeah.
That's TV. That's fiction. Thanks to you both for being with us today, for being here together on The Daily Briefing. Just to say a little bit more about Times Visual Community Streetwise Hebrew, those are bite-sized audio Hebrew classes led by Guy Charette, our host, and available to Times of Israel community members. In the meantime, have a very good week. Shavua Tov, and see you here tomorrow on The Daily Briefing.
Thanks, Jessica. Take care.
Bye, Shavua Tov.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle-Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.